Hi there. Sorry about the late delayed start.
There's a better world that's coming. Tell you why. There's a better world that's coming. Tell you why. We will beat 'em on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world that's coming. Tell you why. Better world is coming, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free, there's a better world is coming, don't you see?
And there we go. Now we're going to talk to Desiree with Food Not Bombs Tampa.
Desiree, I'm going to introduce you as a human rights activist and peace activist. Is that fair?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, super. I have known this fine person for quite some time. I've known her as a person who doesn't just talk the talk, but walks the walk. And I know there are several issues right now that any activist who is awake is concerned about. And since you're an activist who I take very seriously, I was going to ask you, what issues are foremost in your mind right now here in November of 2016?
Sure. There's several things happening at once that are all, you know, really critical. There's, of course, with the election of Donald Trump, as the president-elect, we're dealing with a lot of, like, nightmarish scenarios with the appointing of numerous people to high-ranking offices that have connections to white nationalist organizations, to groups that are being monitored by the Southern Poverty Law Center as being hate groups, and what that means for vulnerable communities, for marginalized communities moving forward. These are folks that have historically been vocally anti-immigrant, vocally anti-Muslim, and, you know, these are exactly the people that are going to be, you know, charged with policies that will affect these communities. So that's something that we've been watching unfold. We've been doing a lot of organizing around showing vocal and visual resistance to Donald Trump being elected and to the choices he's been making subsequently. Also, there's the Dakota Access Pipeline, and that struggle that's, like, raging on. It's beautiful resistance. There's over 200 indigenous tribes inside of this encampment in North Dakota that are fighting Energy Transfer Partners pipeline that they're putting in, and they're going to be boring under the Missouri River, which millions of folks downstream and the Standing Rock Sioux Nation have as their only water source. So we're talking about ecocide, which spells out to genocide of indigenous communities. So that battle is raging forward, and it's key because, you know, when the pipeline originally is supposed to go through areas in Bismarck where white communities are saying no reroute, you know, the pipeline got rerouted. It's going through treaty land, which is the supreme law of the land. And when indigenous communities say no, they bring out riot cops and they bring out DAPL security, which has been incredibly vicious and violent with unarmed protesters. You know, notably a young woman who was handing out water that had her arm essentially blown off by a concussion grenade. You know, and DAPL security and riot cops that have been called out from several other states to the cost of North Dakota taxpayers have thus far been completely unapologetic, unregrettable, nothing, no emotion towards affecting this woman's life from this day forward. They, you know, and the violence, this should be a moment of self-reflection on what they're doing to defend corporate and fossil fuel profits over human life. You know, and then there's ongoing struggles that are going on in places like Palestine. It's also scary with talk of Mike Huckabee being appointed as, you know, the ambassador to Israel when he's noted as saying historically that there's no such thing as a Palestinian. So, I mean, there's a number of different issues playing out. And, you know, along with Donald Trump's policy proposals is, you know, in his 100-day plan, he notes that, you know, he's going to allow for the Keystone XL pipeline to move forward. He is one of the funders of the Dakota Access Pipeline, and Energy Transfer Partners and Kind donated to his campaign. So this is huge intersectionality. This is connecting all the dots of all the struggles, climate chaos, women's justice, immigrant justice, racial justice, And we're just seeing, like, what I feel is worst case scenario and you know, horrific ramifications in all cases.
Let me ask you a question, Desiree. You know, you're a person like myself who watches political, let's say, political trends. And to understand that, we use a variety of resources, from personal connections and people that we know to sources of media, both commercial and alternative, probably one of the better words you could use. And I want to ask you, you know, there have been, over the course of the last couple hundred years, there has been multiple threads that we could call America, this American fabric, some of which are very altruistic, or at least espouse some really good values, some real humane values, the values of enlightenment, but also at the same time, there's these strong, twisted Calvinist streaks, these very oppressive racist threads that run through it, and are evidently every bit as strong today as they were a couple hundred years ago.
Mm-hmm.
When you see America, at least to all intents and purposes, to all appearance, electing a Trump, what is your explanation for that? How do you see that playing out? Is it a, you know, they fooled people? Is it this kind of racist xenophobia appeals to a significant number of people? Is it a product of the malaise and non-participation, which we could probably argue is there for a particular reason? So
yes.
What do you see? What do you see the explanation for this Trump phenomena?
Well, I mean, I think that since day one, there's been a dual narrative in this land that's gone by, like, the predominant narrative, which is oppressive, genocidal. It tells history by the voice of the victors, who've been bloodthirsty, by and large. And then there's the other narrative, which is the oppressed, people's struggles that have raged on since oppression began. And I think that, in my opinion, we had a speak out after Trump was elected to address anxieties and fears of the communities about Trump being elected. And one of the things that people noted as being a possible cause of this and a concern is historical amnesia. And if people it's no surprise, and I think you referenced it with your question. I mean, it's no surprise that you know, people are kept very complacent. They're kept culturally and socially tone deaf, and it's a very self-centered society, which tries to make it so you don't need to care. You feel very disenfranchised. So already you're not going to be fighting for other communities. So I think it could be a number of things. I think it could be historical amnesia, keep continuously replaying these sagas over and over and over again that have mountains of casualties and repeating the same mistakes. And every time there's a progression, there's a backlash. And that's a trend that's gone on in this country. Anytime there have been progressive movements and liberation struggles that have happened, there have been a great backlash, like a white backlash against this. And I think the dangerous thing with Donald Trump is that he knows he's stirring up a wasp's nest. He's taking folks and playing on fears and xenophobia, hate-mongering and fear-mongering, and he's stirred up a veritable wasp's nest of people that are willing to violently exclude huge swaths of our communities, of what this land is made of, to make it an ethnocentric nation, and he's pushing and promoting that. And I think this speaks a lot to, you know, this tyranny of the two-party system in this country, where you have these really sensible policies being proposed, like ranked choice voting, which was proposed by the Green Party as a way to break the cycle of the two-party system, where we could actually take a chance and know that we have a possibility of having a real revolutionary person that could make the kind of changes that care and for the dignity and the humanity of all communities. So I think it's the tyranny of the two-party system, the disenfranchisement and marginalization. And, you know, I think what helped the election along, of Donald Trump along, was that, you know, there was over 700 polling places less than there were in the last election that there traditionally are, and most of those are in impoverished communities where transportation is an issue, where people have to get to work. They can't wait for hours in line. There was one polling place where only one machine was working. There's thousands of people waiting to vote. So I think, you know, nothing in this country seems like it's helping along with people who are going to be affected the most by these insane policies that are proposed by these candidates. You know, there's nothing to help them along to empower them in the process. So when people don't feel empowered and they don't feel like their choice matters, you're going to have this kind of, you know, I don't think it's apathy, but this, you know, lack of, like, vitality and feeling like we actually can make a change. So, I mean, it's a number of things that are working against us, and they're all purposeful. None of this is accidental.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. Let's turn away from this country for a moment, and let's look at the terrible, terrible crimes going on in the Middle East, from Turkey all the way to India and Pakistan. But let's talk for a second and focus on Palestine and Israel.
Mm-hmm.
One had some hope a few years ago that between the pressure that Europe was offering and at least the lip service that the Obama administration gave to maybe a slightly more even-handed, even though they didn't actually do it, they went ahead with business as usual. Do you see any hope at all of at least some kind of restraint on Israel in the next few years?
I mean, I don't particularly with this cabinet that's being ushered in. I think that the situation there is going to be greatly exacerbated. I mean, you're seeing, like, Israel, like, they're feeling totally empowered to do things like pass, like, a ban on the Muslim prayer coming from mosques on the loudspeakers. That should be a religious freedom. That's something that's creating all of this hatred and anger and rightful rage and frustration. You know, the fires that are raging on in the Haifa region, it's just, this is giving pretext to, you know, mass arrests or 16 Palestinians that have been arrested. And some of these folks are people that Israel has killed their children. You know, it's the situation is going to be greatly exacerbated. Like I said, with Huckabee, if he's, like, appointed as the Israeli ambassador, like, that this is problematic for Palestinians. They're talking about, you know, we're talking about a continued ethnic cleansing. There have been no real moves for Palestinian liberation. There have been tokens, you know, like the flag flying at the UN building, but there's been no real moves that have helped people, like in Gaza, with getting the equipment that they need, the materials that they need for clean water, for the rebuilding of their land, which was decimated by Israel in 2014 while Obama was in office. I mean, and that was a lot, you know, perhaps more positive for Palestinians than having Donald Trump. And so I can only imagine what's in store for the Palestinian people. So, you know, the killings is like 240 since October of young Palestinians by Israeli Defense Forces. And, I mean, it's just continuing to happen. There's no breaks on this train that's, like, raging out of control. So I don't see anything positive really coming except from people uniting and demanding that something be done. But I think it's really maybe ironic that Israel, the Haifa region is burning, and there are numerous countries coming to their aid, including Palestinian civil defense, which is going there, sending teams there to fight the fires that are burning their stolen land to assist the Israeli people. And Gaza still is lying in ruins. And assistance, one after the other, after the other, flotilla after flotilla after flotilla is intercepted. People are arrested, and the goods just sit in Israeli storehouses. Like, you know, I just think it's really ironic that the world is coming to Israel's aid, you know, rightfully for these fires. But, you know, don't we take a look at what Israel has caused in Gaza, in the West Bank, and how these places are left to lay in ruins without anybody, like, you know, really making serious moves to fight it, anybody that has the power to, you know?
Well, The one thing I try to think of as positive is that when things do get bleak like that, like they seem to be headed right now, that people do tend to rise to the occasion, and the forces of good do rally. And I'm hoping that that's the good that will come from this rather difficult situation. Any final thoughts?
I mean, the only thing that I can think of that I'm feeling is we just have to keep on fighting. Like, it is maybe a positive ramification that people are rallying, that it's unifying, that we have this monster that's trying to cage and destroy every beautiful thing. But also I'm getting to the point in my life where it's unacceptable it's unacceptable what's happening in Syria. It's unacceptable. Like by and large, like, people are being destroyed. Their bombs are dropping on them. They're being terrorized. This is traumas that, even if they survive, it is going to play out in generations to come. So this, it's unacceptable, and there needs to be a massive change. And now we have to fight harder than we've ever fought before, because we're facing a really, really, really dark time. Like, I just keep feeling like we're about to be the scariest parts of history books. And I think that we have to fight differently, we have to think differently, we have to organize differently, we have to do everything we can to stop what we're facing and what people are facing around the world, because we have to never give up.
Well, my friend, thank you for all the work that you do.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. You have a good day, and we'll talk to you again soon, okay?
You too, sir. Take care.
Bye-bye. Emeny, this is, by the way, we're talking to Emeny Dillick, publisher of the Progressive News.
Press.
Progressive Press. And an author in her own right, a political commentator, international raconteur. And we have the great honor of having her to talk a little bit about some of the news stories that are in the press. And, you know, one of the first things I wanted to talk about was this whole idea of faux news or fake news. What's your thoughts on that?
Let's talk about fake news. And if you realize that this fake news narrative and the Russian hacking claims both started at the same time, circling the U.S. corporate media, so they are very connected. A lot of people might be missing the point on this, but we need to understand why our government is focusing on so-called fake news. What is the aim on this? And suddenly, you know, if we were going to ever talk about fake news, we should have started with the Iraq war, where we still are looking for the WMDs, right? So, I mean, this is a strange time for, you know, Obama to talk about this in his last 15 days. And I was thinking, I was trying to understand the connection, and did some of my own research, and found out that, as you know, the Ministry of Truth was born on December 23rd, 2016, because our president signed the Countering Disinformation and Propaganda Act into law. So they're basically saying, our government is basically saying that any information which is not in compliance with the official government narrative is fake news. So they are telling us which news to watch and believe. And that, to me, is stepping into fascism. Like, once your government is telling you which news are supposed to be correct and which news you are supposed to follow, that's plain fascism. So people need to really understand where this fake news narrative is going. It's not about government trying to be honest. It's about government trying to take the free speech and free press out of our hands. So that's why we need to be very, very careful. None of us, especially like you and I, who are in news business, of course we don't want the dissemination of any wrong information, but we also need to be very, very careful where to draw the line on what is fake and what is real. First of all, we can talk about the corporate media in the U.S., and I just saw yesterday, I don't know if you saw that, the CNN used a screenshot from Fallout 4, which is a video game. I know that because I have a teenage son. Fallout 4 to show Russian hacking. So they used a screenshot claiming this was how the Russians hacked. And of course, people realize that, you know, there are millions of people are in the U.S. using playing video games. And I mean, they are shameless. They are becoming shameless. They're not even realizing how ridiculous they started to look. I don't know if you know that in the last month, within past 30 days, the Washington Post had to retract at least two stories that I know of. One of them is about Russian hacking the Vermont utility, which was totally bogus. There was only one computer with suspecting, there were some suspicion in that one computer laptop that could be hacked by somebody. They don't even know who. And that computer was not even connected to any utility, any internet, anything in the city, in the state. So that was totally bogus. And when they get the reaction from Vermont, you know, people of Vermont and the facilities over there, they had to literally write a retraction on that, saying that that was not correct. So that was one of the major stories that they had to step back and saying we basically didn't do our job properly and it was totally fake news. And the other one was about their supposedly the list of the independent news outlets. Have you seen that list? They had the Truth Out, Truth Dig, Counterpunch, all those independent news that I follow was on that list. They claim, Washington Post claimed that the list was, these news outlets supposedly were spreading Russian propaganda. They were saying that they were, I mean, this is just, I'm telling you, McCarthyism 101, you know, we're going back to this red baiting. Yeah. And, but they faced legal action. Few of those outlets decided to just, they forced them to retract because they said, listen, if you're not going to prove and show evidence that we are, you know, funded by Russia or getting some kind of, we have some kind of connection to Russia, then we're taking you to court. Which on their right, of course they're right. You know, if I was in the list and I had the funds, the money to do that, I would absolutely do that. You know, you can't just put a news outlets on a list saying that these are Russian propaganda outlets. I mean, people are following these outlets and show some respect. And they literally had to like retract that one too. And then they got that list from a website, obscure website called Prop or Not, which no one knows who they are. I went to the website. They don't show who they are. They don't disclose who behind it, who's funding it. So it's like this some secret website comes up with this list and gives it to Washington Post, and Washington Post just publishes it.
It does seem to suggest that when you're calling out somebody else's fake, but you don't reveal your own sources and your own standing and your own bias, it does seem to temper one's enthusiasm for that list, wouldn't you think?
Yes, exactly. I mean, it always reminds me of this. I mean, these are major outrageous claims, and one of my favorite quotes of all time, especially as a journalist and writer, investigator, it's Carl Sagan, one of my favorite scientists. Carl Sagan said, "Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence." So you are claiming. Do they even understand where this is going? I'm pretty sure they do. I mean, if you start saying, you know, if you start Cold War 2.0, Russia hacked the U.S. elections. Russia hacked the U.S. elections is such an outrageous claim that. Without solid evidence, I mean, our government and the mainstream media right now are looking like idiots.
Amity,
because there is no evidence. There is no evidence.
Don't you remember the talking point? 16 different intelligence agencies.
17.
16. Who's counting? It's the Washington Post. Come on.
And actually, I went to those 17 intelligence agencies' websites, and there was no indication of any kind of claim. There were only two statements. One is from Homeland Security, and the other one was Okay, so there were only two statements put out, and both statements just said that they were looked like Russians. It seemed like Russian hackers. Modus of operandi. So it was never a conclusion. They never concluded it. And interestingly enough, one of my friends, I have a lot of these citizen journalists, one of my friends, and I'm going to give his name. His name is, I got his permission for that, Lawrence Sansa. He's on my friends list. He called every Secretary of State office in all 50 states of the United States and talked to their assistants. And every one of them said, all of them, that their voting machines have never been online or connected to internet since the internet became available. Never. So how did the Russians hack these machines if they were not even online? I mean, this is one person, one citizen journalist, within his own right, just with a phone call, was able to get this information. Do you think the CNN or Washington Post don't have the resources to call these people to find out? What? It's incredible. I mean, and he called all of them, verified that none of them were ever online. And then the next day, just a few days ago, Forbes, which is a lot of people consider pretty reliable publishing, even though they're more on the economic side, they reported that the U.S. government's so-called list of Russian hackers is a fabrication because a company called ZOR Security, also known as ESAGE Lab, E-S-A-J-E Lab, was on that list. And the owner of that ZOR Security explains in the Forbes article that they are a technical research and development company which worked with the U.S. government. They worked with the U.S. government, and they are, I mean, it's nothing to do with cyber espionage. They already had the connection with the U.S. government. So I am imagining our government checks these organizations before they do business with, right? Before they contract them. They contracted this ZOR Security for technical research and development. Now they're saying that they are part of this Russian hackers list. So she was, the owner was surprised, shocked, of course. She says, what we do is nothing to do with cyber espionage. I'm not saying that hacking doesn't happen. Hacking, well, we know that our government, thanks to Edward Snowden, hacks into our emails, our phones and computers. So there are hackers out there, even employed by the government. But there is no direct, solid evidence of Russia hacking our elections. And they don't even explain how it was done. Like, they don't say the voting machine. If the voting machines were hacked, obviously they weren't, because there's no evidence to that. So what other ways Russia was able to influence or hack our elections? Did you understand that? I didn't understand that. Did you?
Well, no. We're just supposed to take the buzz. The general, Steve Colbert coined the phrase truthiness. I'm afraid that in this age of a twit president, truthiness is the best we can hope for.
Yeah. And
while, those of us who kind of enlisted as citizen journalists who value truth, find ourselves very much on the outside of very much of the local, of the, political discourse, because the standards of what, is publishable, evidently, is really quite different than it used to be once upon a time.
Yes, and also I forgot to mention that there's an organization there, a media watchdog. They watch the media accuracy and the publishing. They're called accuracy.org. They reported that Jeff Bezos, who's the owner of the Washington Post, after purchasing the Post in 2013, I don't have the exact month, within 6 months, he landed. He has another organization company called, he owns it, Amazon. Amazon, right. I'm sure everybody knows that. Amazon landed a $600 million contract with CIA.
It's a coincidence.
Yes, and they never disclose that when they're talking about information coming from CIA or whatever. They never disclose that. So how could you trust these people any longer? I mean, it's clear they have direct connection to the government, especially CIA. It's clear that they at least retracted at least two stories, which means that they don't really adhere to any sort of journalistic standards anymore. They don't even check their stories. They just put it out there. And then once people catch that they're lying, they try to fix it. They don't even change the title of the article. They just put like a little top paragraph on top. So when we talk about fake news and all these claims, we really need to understand why this narrative is out there now, why there's so much put on Russia, basically starting, like I said before, Cold War 2.0. And we need to understand why that's happening and also why there's so much emphasis on fake news right after, you know, our president signed this, the Ministry of Truth law into action. So,
Let me ask you a question about that. Hold on one second. Now, if it's, you know, if our supposition is true that Trump is demonstrably more volatile, that Trump is not the ideal statesman. Why? Why? What possesses the Obama administration to lock out diplomats, to kick the Syrian-Russian hornet's nest, and exacerbate relations with Russia as Trump enters the presidency? I don't understand that. What's your thoughts on that?
Okay, well, my theory on that is they were wholly, the entire war merchants and the neocons were betting on Hillary's presidency. So because they were preparing with a war with Russia. A lot of people don't know this, but because I follow NATO's work as part of my job, because I'm interested in, you know, international foreign policy, and I grew up in a country that was part of NATO, and now I live in a country that's basically helped create NATO. I find it interesting to follow its work, what it's doing out there. And I've been following NATO's actions, military buildup, rhetoric for years and years now, that I can clearly tell you they were planning a direct confrontation with Russia. And their girl, the person the president was going to start that was Hillary Clinton. So, and she didn't get elected. We had our Brexit, which I predicted was going to happen. Now they only have a very limited time frame to even push it further to aggravate Russia, maybe get Putin act into it. Do you know? But he's not falling for it, obviously, if you know that not only he refused to remove our ambassador or our diplomats from Russia, he invited them for the New Year's celebration. He said, you know, these people and their children are familiar with our country. Some of them have been here for years. I'm not going to just extract these people and kick them out of my country the day before New Year. So he didn't fall for it. He didn't fall for it. I mean, they are really, really pushing for a direct confrontation. I don't know if you remember. I don't remember where was it exactly. It was some sort of a UN event, I'm going to guess, where Hillary Clinton, when she was the Secretary of State, was screaming, literally screaming from the top of her lungs that Russia and China were not paying a price for a Syria situation, that for not allowing us to topple Assad there. So she was screaming, she was saying, Russia and China must pay a price. So my understanding is a direct war with Russia was in the plans, and it's because now Trump sounds like he's more friendly to Russia, like at least he doesn't want to war with them, sounds like it, and he has some he says he prefers better relations with Russia, which I think is the rational, logical thing to do. But of course, this is directly against the neocons, the project for new American century. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's not gonna threatening the idea of American hegemony around the world, and that's creating another, you know, maybe like Russia. Even though I don't really see Russia as powerfully equal to the U.S., we are still the most powerful country when it comes to especially military. But I believe that NATO was preparing a direct war with Russia. So and that is not happening. So they're pushing it. The President Obama tried to push as much as he could, because I believe he got a lot of criticism for not being active enough in Syria, even though, you know, we covertly supported the opposition there. But that's what they're saying. So this is my understanding. This is, I think, kind of like the last push into more direct confrontation with Russia. But I don't know where it's going to go. It doesn't look like Putin is biting it.
Now, let's talk about Syria a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Many of us have heard the information about the pipeline and this being a very, very powerful driver for this necessity for regime change there. Now, you know, it seems to me, I got to say this before we get to fully to Syria, you know, for a country like America that has been involved in regime change so globally,
mm-hmm.
from, oh, Vietnam with Diem to Iran when we overthrew and instilled the Shah, you know, and Saddam and on and on.
Latin, don't forget the Latin America. Yeah, exactly.
And Ukraine and across Central America as well as Southern America. Think of the Allende assassination where he committed suicide and only used a machine gun twice on himself. to have this country cry foul when someone's investigating, you know, or allegedly tampering, you know, it's just silly. And I actually heard Brennan on television yesterday being interviewed, and he said, well, of course, there's a lot of countries that are trying to do espionage in America. Well, duh. You know, give me a break. But, okay, and I digress. Back to Syria. What's your latest hearing? What are you hearing from friends on the ground in Turkey? Of course, we've heard the terrible terrorism acts, if that's what they were, in Turkey. What mm-hmm. are you hearing from your contacts on the ground over there?
Okay. Well, one thing I think maybe we need to clear that I know your listeners are definitely much more aware than general public in the U.S. because of your programming. And we have talked about this. You had me on and other even more qualified people to talk about Syria on your program, that from the beginning – we knew that this was a proxy war as opposed to a civil war. What we understood that the people that were fighting against Assad, 95% of them were not even Syrians. They were mostly mercenaries that were trained, armed, and funded, and that were just brought into the country. So, which is a very similar situation that happened in Afghanistan and Libya before, and you know the same tactic, basically same plan. We started to get a lot of information on Aleppo, and I wanted to make talking about fake news. First of all, I am very uncomfortable when CNN calls President Assad's administration Assad regime. Like he is some sort of, it's kind of like saying Obama regime. It is their government. I mean, we might not like the idea of him being elected there. He was elected. And there were actual international observatory people there observing the elections. So it was a pretty legitimate election, and he got elected. You like it or don't like it, that's the story. He is the legitimate leader of that country. So when you say regime, it's a different way of, you know, it has different meaning on it. And most of the Western media, BBC, including CNN, even NPR, all use this information from one or two groups or organizations supposedly giving information from Syria, right? And that's a very, very important distinction that we need to understand. We need to understand where the information from Syria is coming. Do you remember this little kid? He was so cute. He was in an ambulance. He was like about 4 or 5 years old with this cute haircut all over dust and blood on his face, just sitting there calmly. That was provided to CNN by a group called White Helmets. Okay? So this group, White Helmets, also provided information, supposedly, to BBC, NPR, and other, I think even the Guardian, UK Guardian, used information from them, White Helmets. So this is a group that spread that video of that little boy in the ambulance. And they were established in 2013 by a British military officer, a retired guy. And US, UK, and Europe provided funds, millions of dollars, for these White Helmets, and they were supposedly located in East Aleppo, but the independent journalists that were in East Aleppo during the siege and during the liberation of the city from these terrorists never encountered them. Nobody knows who they are, where they are, and after the liberation of the city, Aleppo, as we call it in Turkish, Halep, I like the word Halep better. So when I say Halep, it means Aleppo. Halep's liberation, they were nowhere to find these White Helmets. So it's a very shady group. Nobody knows who they are. They were funded and established by the West. And this is the organization provided that video. And everybody got so upset about it. Everybody was... I'm not saying if the video was fake. I am just saying that we don't know who these people are. We don't know who this kid was. We don't even know if it was in Syria. So the another organization that is called Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, SOHR, is another main organization that I know CNN and BBC and even MSNBC got their information about Syria, about Aleppo especially, from that organization. That organization is a one-man operation based in United Kingdom. One guy. And he claims that he has four contacts, four people in Syria who give him information on Syria. So these are the shady groups that we were getting our information on mainstream media. And mainstream media, as usual, like I said, they don't really check this their background of where they're getting this information. And I don't even know how they connected. Like, I don't know how CNN connected with Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, who gave them the information, or White Helmets. But they're not reliable. Like, the information the CNN was putting out there, MSNBC was putting out there, BBC was putting out there, it was not correct, basically. They are, you know, clandestine groups, and we don't know who they are. So, and we have reported that, you know that, on your show, that local news in the city of Hatay, Hatay, in Turkey, it's a border city where there were refugee camps, that there were some secret groups they couldn't identify. It could be NATO, it could be anyone else, it could even be Turkish, but they were speaking a foreign language. They were training terrorists or opposition forces to fight against President Assad in those refugee camps. So, like I said, it's the opposite of basically what we heard on our mainstream media. A group called Al-Zinki, A-L-Zinki, beheaded a 12-year-old boy on video. And this is everywhere. I mean, you can see it. It was actually, like, available to see, which is the U.S. State Department. Our State Department admitted to provide support. I follow State Department's briefings, the media briefings, press briefings, and the speaker admitted on video that we provide support for this Al-Zinki group, and anyone can verify that. And then this group beheaded a 12-year-old kid on video. And then our State Department said, when confronted with this fact, our State Department said that they're going to pause. They're going to pause, not even stop or like, they didn't even deny the connection. They just said, we're going to pause our support for the group until we do our research, do our own investigation. So these are the kind of groups that we were supporting. And nothing to do with them being moderate, nothing to do with them wanting democracy or freedom or anything like that. So when people say that, it really upsets me when they say, oh, the Aleppo has fallen. What is it fallen into? It's it's not fallen. It's liberated from terrorists that were besieging the city, east of the city. 100,000 people were under their control for 3-4 years. So so many, you know, Syrian soldiers, so many people died, and Syria asked Russian help to get rid of those terrorists in that city. And then now, actually, I have it on my page. You can see that they are starting to rebuild the city, which was so nice to see. Some of the schools already reopened on the east side, and people who were able to escape but had to leave some of their relatives behind, or able to, you know, get together again, find each other. It was very emotional. And for the first time in 4 or 5 years, they celebrate the Christmas, because many people don't know, but Syria is a very multicultural country. There are a lot of Christians there too. So they all celebrated Christmas together. It was wonderful to see. So there is a lot of, again, fake news that are coming from these shady organizations that we don't know, and we know basically who are behind these organizations, but we don't know how CNN or, you know, our mainstream media, corporate media, connected with them, spreading this false information about Syria and about Aleppo. And I wanted to mention that this is a very important part of the Syrian conflict, that now the city is doing better. I believe it's 95% liberated, and it's not fallen into the dictator's hands again. You know, talking about fake news, this is what I'm learning from my contacts in Syria and at the border of Turkey.
Unfortunately, recently there's been a series of what looks like terrorist acts in Turkey.
Yes.
Although we know that many, even Western governments, are prone occasionally to the false flag type activity. Do you think this is in fact a legitimate attack by conservative forces, or do you think this is, your sense of it, is it that, or is it something else?
No, I mean, the attacks they're clearly videotaped, just like the poor Russian ambassador, Mr. Karlov's dad. He was there in the museum for an opening of an exhibit. And so there were a lot of videos already taping and photos. That's why we were able to see it clearly what happened. And also this nightclub shooting on the New Year's Eve in Istanbul, also that there were a lot of cameras, so you can see that it's real. I mean, the context of it, why it is happening, that needs to be discussed. I believe that both of them, or also, by the way, the second shooting, the Reina nightclub shooting, ISIS supposedly claimed responsibility. That's what the Turkish news are reporting. I don't go to ISIS's Twitter or website ever, so I don't know. I'm just relaying the information to you from Turkish local news. And they're reporting that supposedly ISIS took responsibility for that shooting. And it's saying that it was because Turkey is getting closer to Russia and supporting Russia's activities in Syria. So that is why they were revenging. It was an act of revenge on Turkey because of Turkey's close relationships now with Russia. So there were 39 people were murdered, a lot of injured. And I found some information on the murderer. Supposedly it's one person. His passport has a Kyrgyzstan stamp. And they're saying that he is originally from Uyghur region of China, which is the northeast China, where a ethnic Turkic people, they're also Muslim, live there. And it is partly autonomous, but they are looking to, in a way, separate from some people in there, saying that they want to separate from China. It's also called Turkestan. Some people call it Turkestan, but the ethnicity of them, they're called Uyghurs. So this is very interesting that supposedly he's from that region originally. And this actually relates back to how we talked before about how the jihadist terrorists were being used in different areas of Russia, like Chechnya, or in this Uyghur region in China to destabilize China and Russia, basically. So there were covert jihadi training was going on there. You can follow Sibel Edmonds' reports on Uyghur region. She's been covering it extensively, and she's very good at it. She's a ex-FBI worker who became a whistleblower on some of the information she discovered about 9/11, and it was never taken seriously. And then the government gagged her, stopped her from talking about it, and fired her from FBI. So you can follow her work on this Uyghur region, how the jihadists, they call themselves jihadists, basically mujahideen. Mujahideen literally means one who conducts jihad. So jihadists over there in the Uyghur region are being trained to basically uprise, to destabilize China. And this gentleman, I don't want to call him gentleman, this horrid person, supposedly from that, and then he also has a Kyrgyzstan stamp on his passport. They discovered the passport. So which means that he was traveling from Central Asia. And this is another proof of Central Asia's infiltration by these terror cells. And that was with the help of Fethullah Gulen. If you remember our conversations on this gentleman, how I was explaining to you that he has direct connections with CIA, and he was building these supposedly really good quality English teaching schools in Central Asia. Most of them are closed now because governments of those countries woke up to the fact that he was infiltrating all these suspicious characters trained. And then you remember I told you about the teachers having two different passports, right. Diplomatic passports. So it actually kind of relates back to it. And that tells me if the CIA or Fethullah Gulen and CIA, or, you know, he's a well-known CIA operative, if Fethullah Gulen is behind this killing, this shooting. Also, they're saying that the man that killed Ambassador Carlo was also a Fethullah Gulen follower. He went to Gulen schools in Turkey. It tells me that maybe the CIA is trying to give some clues to Erdogan to get in line. Maybe they're trying to say to Erdogan, listen, if you don't stop your closer relationship with Russia, we're going to destabilize your country. We're going to unleash these jihadists, which you helped us to help. I mean, this is well known. It's reported all over the place that Erdogan was helping, you know, these jihadist groups, many different factions, even traveling from Tunisia, from Libya, coming through Turkey. They were even getting medical treatments in Turkey, in the hospitals, and then the trainings, and then from the border, they were going to Syria to fight against Syrian army, against President Assad. So if Erdogan decided fully, because I can't never trust him, that he really wants to align himself with Syria, Russia, Iran, and China now, then this is his little warning, basically, by the CIA saying, listen, you know, get your ducks in a row and then don't get too close to Russia. Otherwise, you're just going to turn your country into a, you know, bloodbath, just like we did in Iraq or Syria or in Libya. So if they got direct orders from Gulen and CIA, that could be it. So it's very interesting. I don't have, you know, direct evidence, but these are circumstantial evidence. It's interesting that he is from Uyghur region of China. It's interesting that he has Kyrgyzstan stamp on his passport that was found. And we know what's going on in those regions. So that's my two cents to it. I really believe Erdogan is being warned by the U.S. to get in line, get back in line.
Well, you know, it's funny. I heard, I mentioned earlier, I heard an interview with Brennan. I also heard him talk about literally that whole situation. And the first thing he said with, you know, all the feigned outrage he could possibly muster was, now, what would be our interest in seeing fellow hanging out, was it Gulen?
Fethullah Gulen, yeah, Gulen, G-U-L-E-N.
Okay, Gulen. Mm-hmm. What possible interest would we have in seeing him, in helping him to undermine the Turkish government? And I reflected, of course, on your comments and went, well, I can tell you exactly what the purpose was there. And that's an interesting approach, you know, an interesting take on it. You know, and it does also, you know, it's a stimulating question, because of course we know that Erdogan is taking Turkey away from its secular side of things and trying to bring more of this conservative Islam to Turkey. So it's interesting how cross pollinating these things are, using the Uyghurs from the Chinese area and bringing them to stir up trouble here. What a terrible, terrible mess. The last thing I want to ask you about is, you know, when you speak to people in overseas, besides the shock of Trump, are they talking about any particular area where they're troubled most by him? Is it the, you know, relationship with Russia? Is it the devil may care? Is it the boiling down? He knows more than generals in the foreign services. What are you hearing? What's the big concern you hear overseas about the Trumpster?
Well, I mean, I can tell you from Turkish news domestically how they're receiving it. They actually were more afraid of Hillary Clinton, interestingly
really?
Enough.
Really?
Yes, because they knew she was hell-bent on that no-fly zone on Syria, which was going to cause a direct confrontation with Russia, and we're right in the middle. So they knew that if the U.S. decided a direct confrontation with Russia, Turkey being a NATO member, our soldiers were going to be used. So we were going to be knee-deep inside that conflict. Not that we're not, I mean, we already are, the country is already there, but it was going to be even worse because, you know, Russia is not like Iraq or Syria or Libya. I mean, that's a nuclear power. So it was going to be World War III. So some people claim that maybe we avoided it in some way, but knowing how unstable Trump is, they're still very afraid of him. Like, they're trying to understand his exact motives, what he's doing and what he's saying. And so we will see. I mean, they're being very cautious. They're happy that Hillary wasn't elected, but they're also being very cautious. And of course, there is the embedded distrust towards, you know, American presidents in general, from starting from Bush. Clinton had a good reputation in Turkey. But after Bush, you know, with the Iraq war and everything else, and then Obama basically following it in a, albeit in a more covert way, but it's still following the same line of foreign policy in the region, you know, I guess they lost the trust in the American presidents to do the right thing. And they're assuming, you know, they'll use anyone, Kurds, Turks, Turkish military, Kurdish people to just you know, to reach their objective in the region. That's what I'm hearing. They're very, very cautious about it.
Well, my friend, thank you so very much. I sure appreciate your time and appreciate your insight of our adventuresome foreign intrigues in the Middle East. Thank you so very much. You have a wonderful day, and best of luck to your family.
Thank you. Love. Bye.
Okay, next up, we've got Professor Wendy Lin Lee, who's going to talk about her perspective as a human rights activist and anti-frack activist on the coming administration.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm speaking to Professor Wendy Lin Lee of Bloomington University, and we're going to talk a little bit about America in 2017 as we approach the inauguration and anti-inauguration of the next president. And we've already kind of seen what the Republicans have planned for. And then, of course, we've watched them crash and burn right out of the box. So you know, there is help and hope in other spells, as the old saying goes. So tell me, Professor, when you've got a party that is got the presidency, got the Supreme Court, got the House and the Senate, and the first thing they do is put their foot in their mouth and then shoot it. What do you think about a party like that?
I think that hubris can come back to haunt one in ways that are both amusing and telling, quite informative. I would disagree with the claim that they necessarily have the Supreme Court. That will require more votes in the Senate. And I think that at least in the Senate, if the Democrats have the will, which is always a kind of open question for me, the Republicans could actually have a real fight on their hands with respect to any Supreme Court nominee that they put up, but particularly if they put up what I think we all expect, which will be someone to the very far right of both Antonin Scalia and Attila the Hun.
Yeah. I'm picturing a Mike Huckabee kind of fellow, you know, someone cosmopolitan and
hopefully simply smarter, at least than that. I don't take Huckabee. I saw him, I think it was on Sean Hannity for the 45 seconds I could withstand before throwing up in my mouth a little bit. And I actually find him both insufferable and, as I'm just kind of willing to call it as it is right now, just simply stupid. Just dumb. He's just dumb.
I hear you. I wouldn't disagree in the least little bit. Well, see, I'm maybe a little sadder on the Supreme Court side of things. I honestly think that Schumer is going to fold like a cheap suit. I think he's got too much vested interest in the
mm-hmm.
in New York, and I don't think he's. I look at that guy.
You could be right.
I don't see a man who's prepared to fight for principle. You know.
You could very well be right. Schumer is a player. And there are reasons why Schumer and Bernie Sanders have quite a wary relationship with one another. And that is because Sanders is simply a more honest, dignified man, and Schumer is a player.
Yeah.
So, no, you could be right. I just think among the battles that the Democrats could choose and could at least gain some traction, the Supreme Court battle is an area where they could gain some traction. But as I said, it's going to be a matter of political will, and they need to show that the unity that I saw displayed today is not merely, as you put it, a cheap suit, not merely a facade.
I predicted early on, and I'm usually pretty resistant to touting my own horn, but I predicted early on that these guys would fight among themselves to an extent that would benefit those of us who don't quite have their vision of the future. I take endless solace in this right out of the box, let's gut the ethics committee, only to have their obviously ethically challenged, certainly morally compromised Donald Trump leader call him on it. You know, I think, I mean, if there is a less likely scenario of Republican infighting,
you know, though,
I can't imagine it.
I think we want to keep this in perspective, though, because Donald Trump didn't call them on it because for any ethical reason.
Oh, no,
Donald Trump, I mean, let's not accuse him of having any kind of moral compass of any sort. He does not. He called him on it because he recognized, however dimly, and that too is surprising to Donald Trump, but I think he recognized that it was politically stupid, that it was a politically stupid thing to be doing out the gate. And for Donald Trump to recognize even that much, you know, it's like I have to give him a begrudging thumbs up on that one. At least he got that far. He won't get any further, though.
No, I agree completely.
And it won't matter.
And I
it won't matter. Right.
Made the same point in a posting this morning. I said, yeah, here's a guy who refuses to divest, who thinks of government as a family business, who's basically prepared to double deal all the way, never showed his tax records, refuses to divest,
mm-hmm.
is comfortable requesting sexual service from anybody passing by, offers to the world while he's running for president that he could go shoot someone and it wouldn't make a whit of difference. And this guy is troubled by their ethics.
And as I'd say, I don't think he is in any way troubled by their ethics.
Right.
I just think he wants to have as smooth a coronation on the 19th as possible. And he's going to do everything that he has to do in order to ensure that his ascendancy to God is unimpeded, is without obstacle.
You know, I'm wondering if this is Gambit 1. What's the fallback position?
Well, I mean, I think we saw a little bit of, coming attractions. We had a little preview of coming attractions today when I watched with some rapt attention the sort of press conference, the impromptu kind of press conference with Mike Pence and Paul Ryan, who when pressed on the question, well, what are you going to replace ACA with, what is going to come after Obamacare, make very clear that they really do not know. Like, oh, there's lots of ideas on the table, and, you know, we'll certainly be conferencing about that, and my gosh, we've got a lot of good, you know, proposals going. But that's just all cheap rhetoric for
We've got no idea. All we know is that we don't like this thing because it came from Obama, and underneath all that, we really don't like it because Obama's a black man, and so, you know, even if it means 22 million people are going to be without insurance, and even if it means that we're going to do direct and irreparable harm to the elderly and to disabled persons and to children, and even if it means that we're going to return to illegal abortion in the United States, you know, that's okay, because whatever it takes, we just have to get rid of this thing. Your lives are small, and it's not our lives anyway, right? It's not their lives that are on the line. It's all the rest of us.
So you know, the other thing that that I wanted to talk to you about, sobering as all that is a far more serious mm-hmm. subject. I am absolutely puzzled by this whole line of Russia's the bad guy, and let's throw out diplomats and really go to the mattresses, as the atomic football is going to be handed to Donald Trump. What are mm-hmm. they thinking? How do you exacerbate a difficult situation in Syria and only to make it worse? What are they thinking?
Well, it is going to be made worse, and because these are the very complex and just genuinely dirty politics of the, you know, enemy of my enemy is my friend, I think that we will see a number of things. First and foremost, and I think we're already seeing it, an escalation of not only a greater volume of terrorist actions, but ever more violent terrorist actions. And where the Syrians, the Russians, the Turks, the Americans, the Saudis, what the Israelis, the Egyptians, the Tunisians, et cetera, what all roles all of those actors are going to play, that drama isn't going to have, from my point of view, isn't going to have any good guys, but it will have winners and losers. And ultimately, I've been thinking about this quite a bit lately, if I were going to ask myself the question, in all of this very real and very dark and violent drama, who will come out the winner? It will surely be China. Because while we're attending to all of the drama that plays out around the smoochy pie relationship, so far as I can see, between Trump and Putin, and the very uncomfortable realities of the relationships between the Turks, the Kurds, the Iranians, the Israelis, the Palestinians, while we're paying attention to that, China is going to continue to construct, for example, Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. They're going to be strengthening their position on trade. They're going to be militarizing in and around Taiwan and Hong Kong. And at the end of the day, everything that distracts us, I think, probably redounds to their benefit. And the dynamics, the way the political polls are going to shift, it'll be fascinating to watch, or maybe a better way to put it would be, if it weren't so incredibly dangerous.
I heard Brennan from the former Secret Service talking on the tube the other day. And one of the things he had to say I thought was kind of interesting, when pressed on the, oh my God, Russia's tampering with our fractional, disparate, disconnected election system. He said, well, of course, there's a lot of countries mm-hmm. that are snooping in our election system. And I thought, oh my God, mm-hmm. accidentally, you know, the truth comes out. And we see Assange being interviewed on Hannity. My goodness, what strange
on Hannity.
Fellows, huh?
And yet I would say, as you mentioned Assange, I use WikiLeaks as much as the next guy, but I do not trust Julian Assange. He has his own political stakes. He has a long history of some fairly nefarious political interests. And I think you're right that Assange and Hannity are strange bedfellows, but I don't think at the end of the day they're as strange of bedfellows as we might like to believe in virtue of Assange's own specific political objectives. I don't know where the truth lies with respect to the hacking. I do know that there is an important difference, both practically and conceptually, between espionage and the attempt to influence the outcome of an election. And while I also have as much mistrust as the next guy for American intelligence agencies, I am no fan of Vladimir Putin.
Right.
And I say that in part from some personal experience. My kid was in the Peace Corps when Ukraine fell apart. And I got the tiniest window, just a sliver of a window, even in the attempt of the Peace Corps to get their people out of Ukraine before it really crashed.
Yeah.
And it wasn't pretty. It wasn't pretty. So, you know, Putin is a guy who, he's authoritarian, he's a dictator, he has his political enemies assassinated, and I find it frankly chilling that Trump admires him and lavishes praise on him for some of those qualities. It's not just that he's lavishing praise because he thinks Putin is hot. He's lavishing praise because Putin is authoritarian.
You know,
and that's scary.
It is. It is. And all these rumblings about the press and the fake press and too much freedom, and we're going to rethink this whole press conference idea and press pool idea, the private security aspect. There's a lot to be worried about. And as much as I would like to think of WikiLeaks as a force for good, you know, no matter how positive you can say that, you have to also say, why in God's name was it only the Democrats? You know, I don't think the Republicans were any more secure in their persons and effects than the Democrats were. And clearly, the Democrats were demonstrably, massively stupid, having a Gmail of all things, for God's sakes, and handling government documents. But you got to wonder, and it's the first time it's really struck me, because you have such good insight. You know, why was only Democrat stuff leaked? That's
I don't know the answer. I'm not even sure that I necessarily think that's true. I think that whether or not that's true, that will come out. I think the Democrats were stupid, but I'm also extremely reluctant to go the route of victim blaming.
Yeah.
And if I were going to say put on my philosopher's hat here for a minute, I think that we want to make a distinction with respect to WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks is a really valuable resource.
Right.
That does not necessarily mean, you know, like we would not infer from that Julian Assange's intentions were necessarily noble intentions.
Right.
WikiLeaks is valuable. As I said, I use it in my own research carefully.
Right.
I'm very careful about checking my sources, even when I'm using WikiLeaks. I don't take it as an article of faith that what I read there is necessarily true unless I can verify it independently. But it mostly, I have found the material on WikiLeaks to be credible,
right,
which does not necessarily mean that Assange and that his intentions for putting it up are necessarily the same as my intentions in the use of that material.
Well, I think, you know, one can argue that Julian Assange, even having a vendetta against Hillary, which is not outside the realm of possibility. It just seems to me that if he wanted to have a semblance of equanimity or of you know, kind of attacking both sides equally. But I also think that given what we've seen of the WikiLeaks material and maybe other related material from the Democratic Party, clearly if this is the language, and you know, we're grown-ups, we know what politicians talk like, I can only imagine that the Republican stuff is even more horrendous and even more virulent, if you will. One last thing I want to ask you about, and Sure. And this is, again, I appreciate your time. You know, they're talking about basically selling off the Commonwealth, closing the park, selling them off, wholesale sell-off of federal lands for energy development.
Yeah, that makes me sick.
When, you know, you think about the battles that people are likely to sign up for, and I think, and you know from being involved political activity as long as you have, you know there's a fatigue factor. You can only get people up for so many battles simultaneously. And I think in that whole arena of possible Republican missteps, I got to believe that if nothing else, Social Security and Medicare is going to be the one that most people will actually move on. Parks.
Yeah, I think you're probably right there.
Parks may be too nebulous. Women's rights, I'm afraid, as motivated as people are, those of us who believe in, you know, that women are human and, you know, equally human. I think that's going to be the one that really, you know, turns the key. I just hope that we can summon up enough commonality of interest to fight this off.
You make a good point there. I think the intelligent and foresightful among the Republicans, whose motives are quite nefarious, are counting on that fatigue factor, are hoping that the Democrats, the people generally, can just be worn down very quickly, because there's just everywhere there are fires. Everything is on fire. The planet, quite literally, will be on fire. And I even have a kind of example of that. My younger sister, Tracy, is a member of the Lakota Nation Sioux, and she is at Standing Rock right now. I think this is her third trip to Standing Rock, delivering supplies. I think this time it might have been some medical and other just basic winter supplies. Yeah. But she and I were talking not too long ago, and she said, you know, I know it's really tough up there right now because it's winter and it's just so cold in North Dakota in the winter and the winds blow so viciously. And she said, but it isn't even the cold that wears people out. It's the boredom. It's just boredom combined with anxiety about what's going to happen next and where is it going to come from. And I just took that to heart because I think that's what Trump and his minions will be counting on, will be anxiety combined with exhaustion combined with the boredom of waiting for the other shoe to drop, such that, you know, we'll turn our heads away for a moment, the shoe will drop, and then there we will be, 22 million people without health care, our national parks sold off to gas and oil drilling, you know, with no way back. Because after all, one of the things I think we don't get is that we could conceivably salvage or save Obamacare. But once we start drilling anywhere, no matter where it is, right, once that toothpaste is out of the tube, once that environmental destruction has been wrought, there's no fixing that. There's no way back from that. So of all of the issues that confront us, those are some that just leave me honestly in tears.
You know, when I hear that the Trump transition team has asked for lists of people who worked on climate change, who asked for lists of people who dared to work for women's rights, it just...
Gay rights.
It is such a harbinger of what we thought was the past McCarthy era. I just hope there is enough stamina in the Democratic Party, in the people I know. There are people who care and who will continue to care as long as they're breathing. But I just think that the Democratic Party is not going to be worth... They don't have a fight in them. I really don't think so.
Well, we'll find. I hope you are wrong. I fear that you may be right, and we will see. We gotta sort of a nice show today, but it was still far too polite, aka tepid for my taste.
Right.
And we will see after the coronation. We will see what they are actually going to do and what they have the stomach for.
Well, my friend, Professor Lee, I can't thank you enough. It is always refreshing to talk to you. You have keen insight.
Even during these dark days.
Especially during these dark days. Thank you, my friend. I appreciate seeing you.
You bet. Have a good evening.
You.
Well, friends, that's it for today. Special report. Three fantastically powerful women, insightful, intelligent, and powerful. Desiree from Food Not Bombs Tampa, Ms. Emily Dillick, publisher of Progressive Press, and the human rights and anti-fracking activist, Professor Wendy Lindley. Thank you for joining us. Please tune in. Remember, tell your friends. These shows are webcast, so that not only can you listen to them live, but you can listen to them anytime. So tune in, check out your favorites. Thanks again.
Progressive News Network, a new Mercury Media production, where you'll find the voices of activists, the voices of those working to make this a better world. We believe that as we face challenging times, the human spirit can face and surmount the foolish and the short-sighted. Tune in every Sunday, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, for the live show, or anytime you can. Progressive News Network, found at www.newmercurymedia.com/PNN/. We have a future. Tune in and build it with us. Underwritten by Florida Media Labs, produced by Rick Spivak in cooperation with Canary and a Coal Mine Films. Progressive News Network.